pulling them.
Don't run away.
On our agenda had as our main issue today the matter around violence in the facilities. We have a submission from the department. We also thought that it would be wise to invite the inspecting judge, one as an expert observer, so to say, and secondly, to deal with any questions that might arise from members. We didn't expect any pre-preparation from your side, but hopefully, Ms.
Morris,
man, I beg your pardon, Gideon. I couldn't know, get your name. Mr. Morris would be able to field whatever questions, but we really want to deal with that matter. So thanks for coming at short notice. That would be the major part of our discussion. But we had two other items on the agenda. The first one that I would want to raise would be the matter that we've raised 2 weeks ago, I think, and again last week, around the matter around the parole and or release of Mark Scott Crosley. We had asked the department to come and brief us. I've been approached by the department just a few minutes ago and agreed with the department that because they're not ready today and they were not very clear on exactly what is it that we wanted, that they should give that to us in writing within 7 days. Now, just for the record, what the committee wanted to understand are the circumstances that surround the release of Mark Scott Crosley, bearing in mind that that was a matter that had at least two individuals involved, Crosley and I think it was his employer. So we'd want to know why the one is still incarcerated and the other one not. Is that a decision of correctional services or is it a decision of the courts? The second that we'd want to understand that if indeed it is the decision of correctional services, have the victims or those that are the relatives of the deceased been informed and or communicated with? Those are really the two issues we want to understand. We want to dispel the notion that there has been unfair treatment. Bottom line, that is what the committee wants to dispel. The notion that there's been unfair treatment between Mark Scott Crosley and his employer who happens still to be incarcerated. And the department had indicated that they didn't quite understand our requirements. I've agreed with them that they should give that to us in writing, and as soon as it arrives at our desk, we will put it on the agenda. I'm hoping that members are comfortable with that approach. Happiness? Thank you. So we'd ask the department then to give us the details around that matter in writing. The second issue that we would want to dispense with is the first issue on the agenda. Again, let me remind the members and everybody present that when we raised it with the department previously, we were informed by the department that coincidentally our agenda would coincide with the court appearance which happens today. And therefore there was concern from the side of the department not to not to jeopardize the court's proceedings by divulging before it appeared in court. And in principle, we were in agreement with that. Or we were sympathetic, let's put it that way. We were sympathetic to their views. The time has now arrived. The acting DG has whispered in my ear as to what her thinking is, and I asked her to put it to the meeting for us to take a decision. You'd also recall that at that meeting that I'm talking about, we said that our options at the time would be, even if it meant having a closed session, just to get that briefing, we'd have a closed session to have that briefing. Because for us it's important that when we embark on our oversight visit to that very center next week, Wednesday, we must have at least had the benefit of what has come out from the department. That was our reasoning at the time. It is now on the agenda. We'll find out from the department if the court case is proceeding, has concluded, what is the state from the court side, and then members must give us guidance in terms of how we take it forward. The DG has made her recommendations to me, and I said that I would put it to the House. So I'm saying this because there could well be quite a bit of interest from even the media on this matter, just so that you understand the difficulty that we have just on the item around Ms. Wilson. So that's where we are. I'm suggesting that we deal with that matter very briefly and then take a position. And then we move on to the major issue, which is sexual violence and gangsterism in the facility. So I would hand over to you, Ms. Schreiner, to brief the committee as to where we are with this matter and then open it up for discussion.
Chairperson, thank you. Let me start by talking about what's happening with the court case. There was a process around an urgent application on the 21st of April. It was then agreed that the issue would be put on the roll for today. On the basis of the applicant document, there is an agreement that it has been taken off the roll for today. It is not ready for a hearing because all of the papers on the matter are not in order. So the exchange of papers still has to take place before it is put back on the roll. And there is, at this stage, no time frame for it to be put back on the roll. Our concern, therefore, is that the issue of it being a sub judice matter remains, and in particular, given that the documentation preparation has still not taken place, a concern that if our position is, or if we attend to the detail of the content of the matter, and that is, it becomes public knowledge, the court case will be jeopardized. So on that score, we repeat that given that the matter is sub judice and that the documentation is still not even prepared, that we would prefer that we do not deal with the issue of the content of the case at this point in time. We would suggest that a route to go in relation to the content of what actually happened at the time could be made available to yourself as chairperson, so that you're fully abreast of the circumstances around that process. There are two other dimensions that are relevant, and our suggestion is that in the process of your oversight visit to Durban Westville, the Regional Commissioner then attends to those recommendations that came out of the investigation hearing that relate to the tightening up of processes in Durban Westville to avoid repeat situations. There are two categories of recommendations that were made in the investigation. The one relate to disciplinary process against members. The other relate to systems improvement processes. And he will be on board in the oversight visit, which is scheduled for next week, to be able to brief you in relation to that, and to be able to brief you on the steps taken in relation to the disciplinary the disciplinary cases in relation to that. So that chairperson would be the recommendation from our side, given that it's not an issue that is on the court today. If the issue had been being dealt with parallel to us, which was our understanding in our previous discussion, the route that had been proposed may be an option. But that would be the suggested way in which we can steer between the importance of the portfolio committee understanding the issue, being able to ensure that improvements have been put in place in Durban West Hall to avoid a repeat of that type of situation. Thank you.
Let's open it up for members' initial comments on the recommendations that are there. Any members that want to comment? Mr. Fritz?
This is a quick, and I can completely understand the commissioner's position around the matter. I just want to ask the delay, is it from DCS side or is it from the applicant side? I just want to ask.
Chairperson, from the applicant side.
Oh, okay. Happiness? Yeah. All right. Anybody else wants to make initial comments on the proposal on the table? Happiness. Nothing with
that? Chairperson, thank you for the proposal, but I think that we need to accept what the acting DC says.
All right. Before we give you our blessings, Ms. Schreiner, let us just reiterate that one, we're totally sympathetic to the difficulty that it might pose. However, our major concern at the time, and maybe you would need to clarify this when you indicate that the RC would be able to brief us at the center. You recall that our concerns in the main were, what are the controls in the department that, or lack of controls that could lead to a situation where somebody from court to the admission process in the center and for 6 months in a cell for males that, or in a cell that is males and that person was a female, what led to that? Now, I'm hoping that when you are saying to the committee that the RC would be able to brief us on the recommendations and the steps that have been taken, that at least you'd be able to say to us that official X, official Y, official Z were identified as people that slipped up, and this is what's happening to them. Because for us, it's inconceivable that this can happen and it gets swept under the carpet. So without getting into the detail of perjuring or putting anybody in a difficult position, we'd expect that, or let's put it this way, our acceptance of your proposal is conditional on the RC at least being able to say to us, these were the recommendations, and this is what we've done about those recommendations, because otherwise it could just be a delaying tactic, and we would not be very comfortable with that approach ourselves. So the committee seems to be comfortable that we would put it in abeyance. We will get a briefing in Durban, but when we get to Durban, the RC must be able to say to us that these are the 3 individuals or the 10 individuals. We identified these slip-ups, and this is how we've strengthened those slip-ups. And in our book, this thing can't happen again. That is the minimum from our side. Short of that, I think we'll have a difficulty, and we will then maybe have to take other steps. But on that understanding, we will pass on this matter until at least Wednesday when we arrive at Durban West Hall.
Chairperson, there are 27 recommendations in this report. We will ensure that the RC provides you with an update on all 27 recommendations, but in addition, can show you physically where, because there are a whole series of recommendations that don't relate to individuals. They relate to processes and systems within the Westville environment. So those that relate to discipline against individuals, he will give you an update as to exactly on each one. But in relation to those that relate to systems, processes, and precisely the issues of control, he will give you an update on each of those and be able to show you that in practice within the center.
On that note, I then think that as the committee, we accept that we will put it in abeyance at least until Wednesday and take it from there. Thank you very much, Ms. Kleiner, and to the department. So we'd expect that on Wednesday when we arrive at Durban Westville. The agenda item for today is a matter that is very, very serious. I think it links up partially even to the matter that we just dealt with. We had asked the department to brief the committee on gangsterism within prisons, what strategy you have to deal with it, because we think it's a very critical and a serious matter. Sexual violence, what is it that you're doing to curb it, if not eradicate it? And also the vetting of your officials. Now, there are many reasons why we wanted you to come and brief us, and we think it's appropriate that this briefing happens now. One, we, like the whole of Parliament, must focus on our readiness or otherwise for the 2010. That this department is able to handle matters of 2010, but that is just one part of it. It's not the major. The major part of it is what is happening in the facilities. I'm saying that because reading your presentation, Ms. Reiner, and also some time ago I asked the inspecting judge to give me a report. Welcome, sir. To give me a report on these activities in prison. And when I look at it, it begs a few questions, even before we ask you to give us our presentation. Just for the year, January to December, January 2009 to the 31st of December 2009. That was the period that had asked the inspecting judge to give me statistics. According to the inspecting judge, there were at least 11 incidences of death attributed to officials in the various centers. And from where I'm sitting, I need to ask the question, when we talk about gangsterism, are we just talking about the 26s and 29s, or is there a creeping sense of this type of behavior even from the officials? 11 deaths are 11 deaths too many as far as I'm concerned. So that's the one issue. The other issue that maybe you should talk to when you talk to us, I don't know if it's ever been raised previously, but I'm raising it now. You know, it's shocking that, well, not shocking, but it's worrisome that, again, according to the inspecting judge, there were 27 suicides in this facilities for that period. I don't know that suicides are natural deaths. In the sense that natural death, as I understand it, would be, I suppose, from illness. Suicide might be regarded as an illness, but to what extent are these suicides driven by the environment? And if they are driven by the environment, can we really classify that as not being an unnatural death, for want of a better word? That's the question that I think we need to answer. Because your figures from the department are not very different from those from the inspecting judge. For instance, the department has served 19 suicides in that period to the 27. Again, whether it's one suicide, 19 suicides, it's indicative of the fact that the environment might be the driver of suicide. So, gangsterism in the conventional sense, we want to understand. The environment, we want to understand. And the question that I'm posing now, these unnatural deaths at the hands of officials, I'm suggesting that if it's not curbed, could become another form of gangsterism. That's my own suggestion. That it could become another form. And I'll tell you why. I mean, looking at some of the reasons here, inmates have been suffocated by officials. Some of the reasons given, that the cause of death, according to the autopsy, seems to be suffocation, beaten by batons on the head. Now, an official is involved in stabbing an offender is involved in stabbing another offender. That is bad. But I don't think killing that person is justifiable. So these are very critical matters, and certainly this committee in its current setup is not going to accept it lightly. The rising deaths of an unnatural nature in prisons are a very great concern to us. So the inspecting judge has a role to play, and we'd expect him to play that role. The department has a role to play. We'd expect the department to play that role, the ultimate objective being that we reduce the amount of avoidable deaths, for want of a better word. Avoidable deaths must be reduced in our facilities. So that is the context and the seriousness with which we want to have this discussion. I know that you have a presentation, but maybe before you do your presentation, we should maybe do it slightly differently, because it's become so predictable, and people are able to almost second guess and to answer us. I want to start from Mr. Abram and ask for your comments and your horror stories or your glory stories, Mr. Abram, because you do oversight, hopefully. You belong to a community. You probably have heard these stories. I don't want to make the department give us their presentation first, because it influences us. I want you to be able to tell me, from where you're sitting, what should be happening, what isn't happening, what your concerns are, and what are the real facts that you know, those that you can substantiate. And we will then move on to Mamnyanda and all the way up. And on the basis of those, the department, in your own presentation, would deal with some of those issues. And Mr. Morris, we'd also come to you, because we think there's certain things that you should be doing. But I want the committee this time to lead in directing the agenda. Mr. Abram, you've got 5 minutes, sir.
Thank you. Chairperson, firstly, one must say that the general problem that we see in the country today is a general breakdown of our moral fiber. And this permeates through society at all levels. When we come to the inmate population, you have on the one hand inmates demanding certain rights. You have on the other the forms of brutality meted out by some officials. Our problem, Chair, is that this moral breakdown, together with a breakdown in discipline, is something that needs to be curbed with the least possible delay. What the possible solutions are, Chair, I'm not a sociologist, but I believe that we need to repair our social fabric, so that society as a whole can become a caring society. Our problem here is that once an inmate goes into the facility, it would appear that in some instances the inmate is being treated like a leper. The idea of trying to correct that person and create out of that person a better human being when that person comes out one day seems to be the remotest thing in the minds of the people under whose care these inmates are left. On the other hand, Chair, there is also a form of intimidation. When inmates who particularly come from backgrounds of criminality, backgrounds of belonging to gangs and things like that, these people also do intimidate the people that are supposed to be taking care of them. So, Chair, I don't know how we're going to find the balance, but something drastic needs to be done. I don't think there's any question about that. Because if we don't get our moral fiber on track, Chair, then we are going to be in serious trouble. For example, Chair, when there are prison rapes taking place, there must be some or other plan or program to curb that type of behavior, that type of activity. Not to make condoms available. Because the moment you do that, Chair, you are busy telling them, boys, go ahead. And that is the kind of thing that we need to do, Chair. Well, you know, Chair, sometimes one thinks that constitutionally we have the Bill of Rights. There are many things that are written in the Bill of Rights, and you take every law, for example, the law says that nobody has the right to lynch me. But the law cannot absolutely deliver me from being lynched. So these are the sort of things, Chair, which are dependent largely on human behavior, how human beings interact towards one another. In short, Chair, in many instances, I think that we've lost our humanity. We are no longer a caring society, and we need to bring back those values. Otherwise, Chair, these problems are going to remain endemic, and we'll come to a stage where they'll become totally uncontrollable. Sorry, Chair, having called on me off the cuff, these are some of my observations, Chair. Thank you very much.
Yeah, you'll get used to my style of sharing, so now and then you'll be called off the
cuff. I appreciate it.
Ms. Nyanda.
Thank you, Chairperson. I also want to say, in the centers, we've got both problems. The inmates themselves, they've got problems. The staff, they pick and choose inmates. Those they favor, they treat them the best. And you don't know, sometimes you find out that the best inmate is treated the best because he's tying with the staff officially. And the staff officially, he's the one who brings all these things from outside, inside the center. I remember one time, one official in Barberton was caught bringing dacha inside the center. And it was investigated, and it was found out that the official did that. And the officials, they bribe the inmates in prison. They give them money. And why? Because some of the officials, they don't qualify to be there. And they pay these inmates to write for them all the assignments, the officials. Pay the inmate so that he must go up, get a senior position. That's why most of the officials are having a problem to manage the center. Because the certificate says you qualify, but practically you don't qualify. It's a problem. Who wrote that exam is the inmate. And if we don't look at that, outside there, we are waiting for these people to come out. Even this rehabilitation,
when you go to centers, some of the inmates, they tell you that the officials, they refuse me to go to rehabilitation. And you ask yourself why. And we find that this inmate qualifies to go to rehabilitation, but the inmates, they are pressing him or her that she mustn't go to rehabilitation. Why? Because he's not in favor with this official. And when these people, they don't go to for rehabilitation, how are they going to come out and be? Because we want them to be rehabilitated and get the best when they go out. Even if you go outside, we bring this thing that Florence Nyanda is going to come out from the center next week. The community will say, no, not that one. Because that one, 1, 2, 3, they will count all these incidents. The gangsterism in the centers. These people are well known from outside that this one is 25, 26, but some of the officials will favor that particular person. Why? As my colleague has said, why do we supply condoms to the centers? Because we are motivating these people to do this thing. And at the same time, they abuse the small juveniles. Why are we doing that? My last one is that when you go to centers, there are those who are eating best. And they will tell you that we don't have this, only these ones are getting best food. Why do officials allow that? Why? Why? Because these people, when they come there, they are all the same. Even if the sentences are different, but they are all the same, you must treat them the way you are supposed to treat them. Why do you pick and choose? In some other centers, we went there in Crossley. Inmates were complaining that if they want to see senior officials, their requests are turned back. Why? Because these people, they want to put their concern, they've got problem inside the center, and they want to tell the officials. Officials, they don't allow them to come and talk to them. Sometimes there's this thing of the church people are coming to preach there. Some of them, they say, we don't go to church because why the official, they allow us to go to church, but when we want them personally, they don't want. Why? When the church people, they allow us to go to church. Church is where they will be rehabilitated, but you people, you don't want to talk to them. Why?
Mr. Fittler?
Thank you, Chair. I think...
Please speak into the mic.
Yeah. Firstly, the problem of prison society dictates the problem of society at large. People who are in prison are people who have committed offenses against society. They've broken the laws of society. And they need to be rehabilitated, to change, to be normalized. They have become abnormal. Now, then, the problem is that when they are in prison, they lose a lot of their rights. All of their rights have been cut off, except exercise and food and clothing. Now, once they are in prison, and once they are doing nothing in prison, they are idle, there's idleness. Then they become frustrated and they become violent. Uh, there are people, the question of gangsterism that is existing in prisons, it exists not only in South Africa, in all prisons right through the world, there's the existence of gangsterism. But it's how you try to cap it that differs from country to country. It's how you treat the inmates that differs from country to country. Because once warders and officials treat them harshly, now they become more violent. That is, the prisoners themselves become more violent because of the treatment that is put on them. But once they are treated as human beings, you sort of cut down that violent attitude in prisoners. Also, prisoners need to be occupied when they're in prison. It means they need to be a lot of exercise, a lot of recreation, a lot of work that has to be done. It means they must not just sit there idly and think of nothing and planning. In America, gangsterism is very high. In many of the European countries, gangsterism is very high. But in the Scandinavian countries, gangsterism is very low because of the way they treat the inmates. Because they regard them as they need to be normalized. You normalize a human being once it's in prison. In New Zealand, in Australia, they've got a way of having interaction between the community and the inmates so that their cultures must be maintained while in prison, the way they've been treated, the way they deal with them outside, the way the punishment that is given by community is done. It means now the elders usually come there in prison and try to inculcate now their cultures while in prison. Now, in South Africa, we are trying to move away from the type of the treatment that was the retributive type of treatment, where society is looking at prisoners as abandoned human beings, as people who have offended society, and therefore society become very bitter against them. And society, when a person comes out of prison, he is treated as scourge of society. So there is a tendency, that there is that problem that we need in society to change its attitude towards people who are coming from prison. The mere fact that you have got once you come from prison, you have got a criminal record, it means you can't get employment because you have that criminal record. I think that's another problem now that antagonizes, that makes them having that attitude, having that way of dealing. I think those are some of the problems that we find in society. It means the society itself has to be educated that these people, when they go to prison, they don't stay there forever. They come back to society, and they mix with society, and therefore they have to be changed. We have to have a changed attitude towards them. I think those are some of the points that I want.
Thank you, sir.
Ma'am Green.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chair, maybe people outside there would look as if maybe we are only talking like this because maybe we want the inmate to be in a five-star hotel. As members have spoken here at Chairperson, I think that all members can agree with me that we feel that the department is not doing their work effectively. Why I'm saying that, Chair, is because the officials, when they take this work, they are aware that where they are going to work, they are going to work with criminals and how they must behave. I believe that there's an art that they do in terms of doing this work. So for me, it looks like they don't follow that. And another thing, Chair, I wanted to say to the department that it looks like they don't check the requirement by Section 36 of the Correctional Services Act 111 of 1998, as amended. That inmates themselves, they've got their rights. But all these steps and this report that we're getting from the Judicial Inspecting for Correctional Service, it shows that there are a lot of inmates that have been assaulted and killed. And there's no report that is coming from the department in terms of explaining to us to say how does this thing happen. And it shows that the officials that have been done this, no one has been arrested. But you can get that the official has been suspended. On that suspension, there's no clue. How long is that suspension? Where are they right now as I'm speaking? What is happening about them? It looks like those inmates that have died there, they don't care about it. But want to say we do care because our department now is called Correctional Service. Ngelimi lakithi sithi ukulungiswa kwezimilo. So we believe that when the inmate is inside in the center, that inmate is there because it must get the rehabilitation, not the violence that is happening inside there. Chair, I think the department got lot of answer to answer us in terms of this. And all these things, well, that and Masinyane, if you can check this document from 2009 up to 12 March 2010, how many inmates that have died inside in our center? How many more have died before, since we don't have any report of this inmate? I remember on a past term, we used to ask the department to give us the stats and tell us what is happening about all these inmates that have died inside in the centers. Since that, we must know and come up with the mechanism of stopping this stigma of killing the inmate inside. And in terms of the assault, it's not only the inmate that is assault. Where in Johannesburg, we find the officials that was assaulted by the inmate. And when we question the inmate, why you do this, you'll get stories like Mama Nyanda that is saying, then at the end, then they'll fight with them. Chairperson, the report got lots of answers that the department must answer us. I don't know whether they do have this report. If they do have this report, I'll say the department, they must read thoroughly this report and tell us that what the inspecting judge is saying, is it a lie or a truth? And if he's lying, I don't know what is he going to lie for. My concern, Chair, is that the department is only occupying their seat in their offices. They don't go down there to the centers where there is work. It's in the centers, not in the office. But they are occupying the office, sitting there, waiting for the false report from their region. As from now, they must take us serious. As we said on our budget, that we pass this budget for them to work, to do the work, not to sit in the office there. It's time now that the office, our members, our officials that are working the office to go down there, Emma Center. And what mechanism can they do to assist the department with improving? There's no improvement inside in our centers because they're sitting in their office. They wait for the false report that the head of the center that they're giving to them. That's why we're going out next week for our oversight, to make sure things are happening in our centers, since that there must be change in correctional centers. Chair, I think I can say it's enough what I said, but it's painful, and I don't know what to say. I don't want to play about my feelings. And I don't want to buy their eyes off the department. Because if there's no criticism, it just looks like we don't want all of us to do our work. I would like the department to take our criticism serious, not because we hate you, but we want to work together with you and make change and difference in our Center of Correctional Service. I thank you.
Mr. Hurst.
Thanks. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think what lots of members are saying to us is that we need to revisit the Constitution, be reminded about the Constitution, and specifically Section 35 of the Constitution that talks, and I don't know the subsection, but it talks about the human dignity and the dignity of a detained and convicted person. The preamble of the Correctional Service Act also talks about treating inmates with human dignity, and I think sometimes we forget that the white paper also talks about that. And I think what Ms. Magwenya and Mr. Ben Fichla and Mrs. Miranda, everyone, and Mr. Abram says, and what they are saying is that I think we need to perhaps remind all our officials on the ground about those provisions in the Constitution. And I find during our visits to prisons and to correctional centers, a strong, Mr. Chairman, the word I want to use is like dichotomy between officials and inmates. And you have, on the one, two power groups, because you have the gangs on the one hand that almost control the prison after hours, and you have officials who are incredibly powerful. And in between, you have the people in the crossfire, you know, the poor France, the ones who are non-gang members. And they, the victims, they get horribly abused. No one listens to them. They're the ones in most instances who, I think, and I don't want to generalize, I think what we're talking here are all specific cases. We're not generalizing. We talk about very specific cases. Those, I think our concern are generally about those people who get caught up in the crossfire, the France, you know, those guys who don't belong to gangs. Those gangs are incredibly powerful within our prisons. I'll give you a practical example. I asked the minister a question the other day around when and where and how the bagless environment has been implemented in Correctional. And it's specifically asked in the context of smuggling, huge scale smuggling going on. The answer I got was, well, I'm, you know, my question, and I don't think it's a minister who answered that question, I must be very honest. The question was, yeah, I'm romantic, they can't apply it everywhere, the person is not. So why do you have a policy that you can't, or that you don't try and implement? That is my first question that I'm asking. The second question is, you know, the question around human trafficking with imprisoned, where, you know, where you get reports that you know it's credible from inside prison of kids, younger inmates, what this is, just turned 21 and they land up in our maximum, like Portsmouth, get put into a specific cell for a gross of cigarettes. You know, this is one example. We talk about large sums of money in prison, even though it's a moneyless society, you have large scales and sums of money exchanging hands within in prison. We're just on the 24th and 25th of April last year, and I'm saying we're talking about specific instances. We had a case of the EST, you know, the emergency support team, a massive assault while doing facilitating and searching, which is correct. You know, they must confiscate phones. But the question is, do they need? In one instance, they stabbed the prison with a knife. One officer stabbed. And I know there's an investigation on, but mothers phone us because they are really, really concerned about the safety of the children in prison. And I don't think we're soft on crime, Mr. Chairperson, when we are defending just the very basic rights of inmates in our prisons. I'm also saying the EST, there's a specific protocol that when it happens, when that search happens, that they need to be video recorded. But they all had balaclavas on. So, you know, the video recording, which the protocol says must happen, has not been applied. So the other thing I want to just quickly talk about, you know, in the Sun the other day, there was this horrendous report again around conditions and treatment of inmates in prison, and they specifically talked about Portsmouth. And it's something, I mean, you know, we've all been there, we know it's like that. I really think, I wonder, when are we coming to a situation where we're going to say, listen, can't we build, and I know it's lots of money, but can't we do something about those conditions practically? Because we have these reports year in and year out, and it just continues to go on. And perhaps we need to look at some point to revisit and say, what do we do with the awaiting trials? And I know, I don't think the remand centers that we're proposing is going to be the solution for that. I just quickly want to talk about sexual assaults and, again, the power of gangs. And I think I want to say that the commissioner is moving in that regard, so I really welcome that. And the last point is the question of mentally ill inmates who are not convicted yet, who are still awaiting trial. The long list. Now, again, it's not correctional services problem. There's one hospital in the Western Cape, I know, Falkenberg, with a long list, and there's something like 15 or 20 beds only. But in the meantime, these people are thrown into the general sections with other inmates. And I wonder whether we shouldn't just, at the point, when you have any idea that a person is mentally ill, just to separate them from the general population, because the hospitals are full. And the other point is, they will inevitably be get abused as vulnerable people. So thanks, Mr. Chair. I think that's basically for me.
Thank you. MPs have exhaled. We're going to allow you to have a dialogue with us. We really don't want a theoretical textbook answer. But we would need you to have a dialogue with us on all these matters that we are talking about. You could use your presentations, but I don't think that a theoretical debate assists in this instance. I just want to close off by saying to the department that this discussion is not limited to DCF controlled facilities. Let me remind you that last week the minister said on her visit to the private prison in Limpopo, she saw violence or brutality that is reminiscent of the apartheid years. So we're talking about all the facilities that you have control over, be they private, be they state-owned prisons. So yes, I'm not sure how you're going to run it from your side, Ms. Reiner, but we'll allow you then to talk to us and after about an hour, I don't know how much time you require, we can then open up and see where we take it from there. But we'll afford you an opportunity to do your presentation.
Chairperson, thank you. What I would suggest, there are a couple of issues that I wanted to just pick up on as an opening set of remarks, and then to hand over to Mr. Motseke and Mr. Dammans to take us through the presentation, but specifically focusing on the issues that have been raised, and certainly not giving us a theoretical presentation. I think it is important that where there is policy that needs to be elaborated on, we do that. But certainly we need to engage with the issues that have been raised. I think from as a starting point, we really do appreciate the reflection back from the Portfolio Committee, the criticism that comes to us from the Portfolio Committee, and we take that as part of building DCS into correctional services that the country can be proud of. So I think that is a starting point from our side as to how we go through. I thought that it would be appropriate, as we go into a discussion on security, to reflect on two things. The one is that indeed the problems that exist in outside society do get reproduced within our environment, and I think that corrections as a societal responsibility is something that is critically important. So for me, part of what we have needed to do, for example, in relation to the gang strategy, is to look at what is the interface between gangs within our facilities and gangs that exist in communities. And if we adopt an approach of trying to deal with security in a silo-sited way within DCS and not recognizing the other factors that feed into it, we will, in a sense, land up not breaking that cycle. So I think that the points that were made in relation to that are critically important. The issue around the treatment of inmates and the importance of human dignity is fundamental to our approach in the white paper. You can't rehabilitate people if you don't treat people with human dignity. But I think that it's also important for us to recognize that part of what we are faced with in our facilities is inmates who do not themselves recognize their own human dignity or the human dignity of others. And I don't want that to be a generalized statement to all inmates. But I think that it's very important for us in having this discussion to recognize that we are dealing with people who have very violent backgrounds, who have committed very violent crimes, who have repeatedly committed violent crime. It's not a once-off issue. We've got people who have been in and out of our system. It is a reality that our officials have to deal with. We have provisions in our law and in our policy for the use of what is called necessary force. The challenge, obviously, is to ensure that we are able to contain it to necessary force and that we don't get to a point where it becomes abusive and excessive force. And those are issues of the checks and controls that need to be put in place. But I think that what I'm saying is that we need, in having this discussion, to also have a realistic understanding of the reality that we face with. A maximum security prison is not a peaceful and pleasant place by very nature of the people that you've incarcerated. The issue that you've also raised around the impact of just locking up a human being, to what extent does the environment contribute to violence, and violence whether it's directed against another person or directed against self, in the sense that you raised it around suicide, is a very real concern. And I think perhaps it's an under-researched concern. It's certainly something from my own experience of being incarcerated. It shifts behavior patterns in a way that is quite extraordinary. It's a very physical process of being locked up, exacerbated obviously by idleness, by frustration, by those types of issues. The issue of remand detention, I'm suggesting that we don't go into it in detail here, but I do think that it's an issue at which we really need to come back to the Portfolio Committee and do a really detailed presentation on the concept of remand detention, that whole remand detention project, because certainly it's not a solution that can lie in a particular facility. It's actually a whole different environment with its own set of complexities. The point that has been made about avoidable deaths, is a very fundamental one. We have at the moment a category of natural and unnatural death. Suicide is not a natural death. Natural death is old age or a disease. So within the category of unnatural death, you have unnatural death due to violence directed against self. You have unnatural death in the sense of violence between inmates, officials and inmates, a variety of different categories of it. And our focus really does need to look at what are the deaths in our facilities that are avoidable. Our ability to pick up on when somebody is suicidal remains a major challenge, and it remains a major challenge in contexts in which you've got the levels of overcrowding that we've got, you've got the staff shortages that we have, and particularly the social worker shortages. But I think that there are processes that we need to look at in relation to that, and perhaps training our officials more effectively on what are the symptoms that actually lead to part of the difficulty is that very often people who are suicidal are not voicing that out. So that is one of the challenges. But suicide is certainly not a real concern for us as a department. I wanted to just indicate that at the National Management Committee meeting in March, late March, possibly early April, but I think late March, we had tabled the issue of the youth. It was the beginning of April. We had tabled the issue of the youth, the excessive use of force, because the concern that you have raised is one that we have picked up on very strongly. Obviously, the particular instances are being investigated, and those the investigation reports will then determine what necessary steps need to be taken. But our assessment was that we needed to look at the phenomenon as a whole rather than look at individual cases, because there certainly is a very alarming pattern that we have picked up on. Effectively, what we did was to determine that the policy as it exists is fine. There's no major policy gap. The critical question is the way in which policy is implemented. And that is where we have put our energy. We are really concerned about the relationship between the power of the gangs and the power of officials, and the extent to which officials then, in instances, have taken, in a sense, the law into their own hands. And I think that there are a number of patterns that are coming up in relation to that. So what we have effectively done from that meeting, and it's something that the National Management Committee will continue to be engaging with as we go forward, is to ensure that the regional commissioners take the issue of tightening the implementation and compliance with that policy very seriously. Because there are standard processes that determine when forces it can be used and how it is meant to be addressed, and at what stage the person in control says that's enough. That is where we've now quelled whatever we needed to quell, and the violence then, or the use of force then stops. We recognised in that meeting that in instances in which gangs are using force, using violence against other inmates or against members, the use of necessary force is an instrument that we need to reaffirm as part of the. I was going to use the word arsenal, but it's the wrong word. But part of the system that correctional officials need to use. But the critical question is, what are the controls to be able to call it a day? So that once you've used the force to stop a riot, to stop a stabbing, to stop a fight, you're able to get things back under control. We also agreed that because part of the issue that we face in relation to these instances is collusion between members, that when you go to do an investigation, none of us saw anything, that we needed to ensure that we pitched the level of investigations at a higher level. So we said for investigations that relate to the use of excessive force by officials, but in particular where an inmate has been either seriously injured, hospitalized, or has lost their life, the investigation needs to be pitched at director level. So we're raising that in order to try and ensure that the investigation will really get to the point of uncovering what has happened. We've also tasked our HRD to look at an intense training process around officials that we can try through a training intervention to reassert the importance of compliance with that policy, but also to deal with the issue that members of Parliament have raised, that very difficult balance between security intervention, the use of force when necessary, but at the same time ensuring that you are treating people with human dignity. What we have also indicated in that in the decisions from that meeting is that the issue of educating inmates around their rights, and in particular their right to report to the head of centre, right to report to inspect the IPCV, the independent visitors, to report to any member of the judiciary that goes on a visit, to report to members of parliament, that their understanding of their rights is enhanced in that way. Effectively, what we have tasked is the regional commissioners to take this as a very, very serious issue with their area commissioners and ensure that within the regions, the senior management, which is your heads of centres, your area commissioners, and your regional commissioners, address this issue very directly. And it is an issue that we will be able to be taken forward. I thought, Chairperson, before handing over to the security team, that I should also just reflect on the issue of the concern that we have also shared, and that the Minister has certainly emphasised very strongly, and that is the issue of the senior managers being in touch with what is happening on the ground in centres. And I think that the discussion that we had at that management committee around this issue reflected precisely that. It reflected a very clear statement from the National Management Committee, which is your CDCs and your regional commissioners, chaired by the accounting officer, that we really do need to ensure that particularly within the region, where people can, they because they are within the region, they have the ability to be able to be present on the ground. In 241 centres that are scattered, that element of accountability and that element of monitoring what is happening on the ground really needs to be lifted up. So that is a strong message that is coming through, and it's one that we certainly hear loudly from the Portfolio Committee and will reinforce going forward. But I thought those were just issues that I could touch on as opening remarks, but then hand over to Mr. Maseki and Mr. Dummins to take us through the presentation, but addressing the issues that have been the concern of the Portfolio. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Commissioner. Thanks, Chairperson and the committee. Certainly, it was never our intention, Chair, to preempt the concerns that the committee have. But what is amazing around it is that at the heart of it, we share the same concerns. Your concerns are the concerns that the management of DCS has, and it may certainly be coincidence that in the course of us compiling this presentation, we seem to have directed, and perhaps at first, which was again not an intention, come across as rationalizing or providing explanation against perhaps what could well be your concerns. It's certainly not our concern. We do at best want to come across as objective as possible, accept the limitations of our system and where they apply, the limitations within the department, because we do honestly think that our engagement with yourself can be very helpful. This includes your monitoring visits and so on. At some point in the past, I have in fact invited that in the event where you come across an anomaly within our system, it's really fairly reinforcing our message if some of the statements comes directly from yourself as you engage directly with our staff. It's a very important issue. I was just wondering, Chair, on the basis of your invitation, even whether this presentation is important in the manner it is structured, or perhaps what we shouldn't rather do is to focus on an issue by issue in the context of the presentation and then stop there and have a discussion around that specific area of their presentation. I've just asked Mr. Diamonds here now who's going to make this presentation about whether he can perhaps, because he prepared himself to make the presentation, he can perhaps come to the presentation as opposed to going into the detail of it and then posing at that stage and then we engage around those issues. So in a sense, and perhaps a bit more broadly, we did want to talk and give you a sense about our environment, what obtains, and to the extent that this applies, to give you a sense about who exactly is in our facilities. And this is really where the statistics come in, because that's at the heart of it, gives you, if you like, an assessment of the threat to security. What constitutes a threat to security within the environment? And that is the extent to which we have provided you with the statistics around the inmates, their classification, including our staff, because when we talk about issues of our staff, we are bringing to your attention a sense of what is our capacity to attend to the threat posed. That's essential. It's not, and if it didn't come across that way in the presentation, the intention actually was really to narrate to you that element, that we are aware of this specific threat, aware of it, this is our response to it. And in a manner of talking, our response, both in terms of the presentation and elsewhere, we have said that our response will be made up of a number of things. It will be made up of our capacity in terms of personnel, and that's the extent that we talk about personnel. But the modern prison is entirely dependent on technology in the management of security threats, and that is the extent which we have, at some point in the context of this presentation, come across as talking about security technology measures that are applied within our facilities. And also, you have also asked a question about vetting and so on. But the sensitivity of that area to us is not only about vetting to the extent that the individual staff are cleared, but at the heart of it is about whether or not we are capable of managing information that is sensitive to enhance our management of our facility. We have also talked about the issues implied in our presentation of management response, because in the absence of knowledge of management, direct supervision, which is a point I think that you are making, that senior management must be there. In the absence of that direct involvement, security issues are compromised within our facilities. And so we have come across, perhaps not so directly as I'm trying to explain it now, we have come across perhaps somewhat disjointed here and there, but the intention was really to try and bring all these issues that bear on security to our attention as our way of responding to the threats that are posed. We'll also talk, Chair, at some stage, and I think that we can pause at that point and again talk around our preparedness for 2010. It's not something, as and when we talk about it, that you'll find a comprehensive answer from correctional services alone. Although we'll talk to our issue, you'll find an absence in this regard, because there is an element of security response to 2010 issues that comes from SAS, that comes from NPA, that comes from justice. And so there has been a limitation in our response here where we were not as elaborate as you may want us to be, because we would have wished, frankly, that these agencies perhaps are also here and engaged on their part. So we have zoomed exclusively on our area, but there is a proceeding. There is a prelude to this thing, which are the value chain issues that arise from SAS, justice, and so on. That attend to the issue of our readiness for 2010. So, Chair, if I may again request from you just to suggest that we zoom into specific areas and talk and dialogue about it as we've invited us to do. Thanks. Mr. Damos may be able to relate to that. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. The presentation, therefore, will then zoom into the areas. I will cover these areas and then maybe pause if you request it. So, to start with, I'm not sure should I use this presentation or can I then, because we will now, can I talk to my presentation?
Whatever makes you comfortable, sir.
So, I think this will be the time saving and then we can again. So I will talk to the different slides. In terms of slides 1, 2, 3, and 4, that's the security for DCS, the current threat that we have to deal with, and the environmental stand. I think we talked to those issues, and then the overview, what are the critical security indicators for DCS. We can then talk about the escapes, the assaults, as well as the unnatural deaths as a group of areas to cover. Now, I'm sure that there's no need to emphasize the fact that the primary objective of security within DCS is to protect the public, protect staff, provide protection, safety and security for inmates, service providers, and other stakeholders. That's our primary objective. And against that background, we have to deal with certain threats within the correctional center, but also threats in terms of the broader population that we have to manage. There's now areas two, and some of these challenges that we have to face is the high involvement of sophisticated syndicates, crime syndicates. And you know we have an increase in the ATD population over the past years. And there's also staff, because of the inmate population, they're sometimes exposed to corruption temptations. And we are aware of that. Some of our facilities are indeed out and do not allow us to respond to the new threats. And then also the ATD population, because they are not classified. There's 50,000 of them normally as an average, and they are not classified in terms of maximum, medium, or whatever. And on admission, you have to deal with all these different non-classified offenders. And we have the area of overcrowding within our facilities. Now, when scanning the environment, we have nearly 29,682 maximum classified offenders. We have an average of 65,000 mediums, minimums around 10,000, the ATD population an average of nearly 50,000, and then we have a portion that's within the state of assessment that still needs to be classified. Now, that's the general trends in terms of the population over these years. The past 3 years that we are presenting to you, the population stay on average around 160,000. And I think when referring to overcrowding, we only have approved accommodation for 114,000. So therefore, that number, in extent of that 114, is the overcrowding proportion of the population. And the, as I said, the ATD population stay stable around 47,000, 50,000. Now, Jefferson, it's also important to note, in terms of sentence offenders, the crime categories, as well as the ATD population, the categories are more or less the same, with aggressive crime categories, the highest, as well as economical, and then sexual. Those three categories, economic, aggression, and sexual, those are making up the category that's important to note. And the same as thing is happening, as I said, with the unsentenced population, that's item on slide 9. So aggressive, economic, and sexual, that's also amongst the awaiting trial population, that's having an influence on the classification of other offenders. So that's important just to note that the numbers that we have in terms of aggressive crimes is equally the same with the ATD population that saw the innocent until proven guilty group. Now, in terms of our staffing, Chairperson, we have an establishment of nearly 40,000 staff, but since July last year, we have divided the staff, security staff, into center-based staff and non-center-based staff. So the group that in fact, working in offices, they are more or less 4,300 staff members. 36,000 staff members are working as center-based staff. That's the categories that we have divided the staff in. So we are continuing cutting on this group, working in offices so that they can work in the prison environment. But it's important to note that because of this, the different shift patterns that we have implemented, people work now longer hours, they 12-hour shifts. But on some days during the week, we have to give them day off because of the 7-day establishment. Within 14 days, a person will work 4 days, 3 days off, and then 3 days and 4 days off because we have to account for 45-hour work week for staff. So there's the shift pattern, and there's also shift pattern as an alternative. The importance to know the shift patterns is during the week, it happens that you only have 50% of your staff available because of the shift that they have to work. And that allows other opportunities that the inmates can be utilized now in programs because staff are also now available in terms of the shift system to attend to different programs. But it's also having an influence on during the week you have escort duties, the courts normally operate, and staff have to, the 50% staff have to take inmates to courts and hospitals and all those other functions. The overview in terms of the indicators, we are measuring escapes, we measure alleged assaults, we measure unnatural deaths, gang-related incidents and sexual assaults and rape, so that we keep track of what is happening. We do an assessment, quarterly properly assessment, so that we can advise regions in terms of the outcome of that assessment on all these different areas. So when we talk to the different areas, as we are measuring it as indicators, you will see in instances there is a downward trend, and in others we still have to tighten the screws to become more effective in some of the areas. I'll talk to the escapes quickly. Chapters, you will notice that the escapes, there's a comparison between the different categories.
I don't know, Chair, if we cannot pause perhaps there, because part of that was to try and provide you with an environmental scan around what at, in very broad terms, constitutes a threat. Going forward, it's actually just making an evaluation of performance against that threat. The point that Mr. Damans did not make perhaps adequately around the staffing issues, which I'm bringing it here because, Chair, as you said, you're going to visit. It's important to ask these questions when you are there. And that question is, what the implication for management of the center, what the implication has been of the two-shift system as you are arriving into the center. The sense I have is that he says during the week you've got 50% of the establishment, but actually in reality that 50% is broken down into two. So at any given time you have approximately 25%. And so the implications of this is that it has reduced our capacity to react to the security threat, and therefore it has limited our ability to open up opportunities for inmates to do quite a number of other things. I mean, it's a blessing for me at the moment that we are going to be able to report to you that of all the security breaches, only one seemed to be going up. When I talk about the natural deaths, when I talk about the escapes, when I talk, all of them are going down. But the case of assault is increasing. And to keep on increasing for a while, I think for a point that Mr. Fika was making, that if you have people, as a result of our shortcomings, if you have people held together and idling, the tendency is for those people to turn against themselves. And this is a universal phenomenon. So they have got enough to worry about things that they must not perhaps be worrying about, as a result of which it then increases tensions amongst themselves. So I'm saying this is a very serious concern. As you know, the minister last week, as she was presenting to you, which was the instruction that she equally gave to us, was that let's evaluate the shift system. And I think it's as a result of the observations that she has made, observations that we ourselves have made. And I'm saying it's important for all of us to have a sense and appreciation of what that threat is. And if there are discussions around that, that specific issue. I think we are prepared at this stage to enter into the discussion.
I think that's a useful suggestion. Are there any comments? Because we really are dialoguing on this matter. We're all seeking answers on this matter. Just around the issues up to now. The environment as pertains to officials and the shortages and or threats that arise from that environment. Let's take Mam Nyanda.
Thank you, Chairperson. On my visit, I visited Omsko Air Center. The complaint about the 7 days establishment, it was that after the 7 days, these people, the staff worked for day off. And after the day off, they prolong the days. And immediately after prolonging the days, they come back with a medical certificate. That is my concern, because all the centers I visited, it was one complaint. That after the day off, they prolong the days. They were even complaining that this soccer 2010 is coming. They won't have staff in the centers because they want to go and see the soccer. And they will prolong these days of the day off. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I'll agree with the evaluation of the chief. And I'm worried, Chair, as we are ready for 2010, and we are still saying we've got a shortage of staff. Maybe the department was supposed to start to tell us that in terms of 2010, how ready they are in terms of this 7 days establishment. Mabunga atingoba no akunguku, sokusele only 30 days or whatever to 2010, and now we're crying about booty, we've got a shortage of staff. Chair, let us evaluate this shift, but also let us get the plan for 2010. And we mustn't contradict this with the problem that we have in terms of the shortage of staff. I thank you, Chair.
Mr. Speaker.
Chair, what I'm thinking, I'm just thinking of the question of Kenkutai, which is the main problem in prison. Gangsters recruit more gangsters from the people who are coming in from prison to prison. There are people there who have been in prison for many, many years, who it is difficult to rehabilitate as it is. That is the habitual criminals, we call them habitual criminals, who have been there for many years. Now they want more recruits from the people who are entering prison. Now, I think it should be the duty of officials to try to cut this recruitment system they are doing. It means people who are first-time offenders, must be cut off. They must have their different sections from the people who have been there in prison for many years. It should be systematized by the warders that new inmates must be separated. Because they are vulnerable to the gangsters. Secondly, the youth, when they come in, they must also be separated from adults, because they are very much vulnerable to these gangsters, to
be recruited as a gangster and to be forced to these sexual crimes. So that it should be the duty of the officials that when on the question of admittance, they must be wary of gangsters recruiting from these new people, from the youth, recruiting from the first offenders. It should be, I think that is one point.
Mr. Abraham, thank you, sir.
Chair, when one looks at the crime categories, the figures provided here, that's now, I don't see the slide number, but I think it's slide 7, for example. I just did a quick calculation. If you take the aggressive category, it's 63,636, and you take the other categories combined, that's economical, sexual, narcotics, and other, 51,936. This is now reflecting that almost half, actually more than half, of the sentenced offenders. It reflects the situation in society, that we have become a very violent society. Now, Chair, what this tells me is that whilst we need to deal with the people that we have in our centers, we also need to have a parallel plan, which unfortunately this committee cannot drive, but this committee can play a major role in getting it driven. And that is, you take for example a couple of weeks ago, you had primary school kids in Malmesbury who burned down the schools because the classes were too big and that sort of thing. Now, Chair, they say that a criminality actually starts where the kid would steal something from mommy's purse, where the kid would, go to the supermarket with mommy and quietly put something into the pocket. That is where criminality starts and eventually develops into something which becomes unmanageable. Problem here is, Chair, that we need to now, according to these figures, work on the prevention of crime. And there, Chair, we need to have a national effort involving other sister departments. We should perhaps help to drive it, but it has to be done. But say one looks down the line a generation or two further on, what sort of society will be inherited by our offspring? And I think that we need to pay attention to, Chair. Finally, Chair, one looks at the awaiting trial detainees crime categories. Again, Chair, this trend is more or less the same. You have 24,212, that's now the latest figures, aggressive, shall I say, people involved in aggressive forms of activity, against 26,470 for the other categories combined. Again, Chair, slightly less than 50% of the total, but still a very, very worrisome figure. And, Chair, you see, the problem is that for every little thing, you will find that people tend to turn violent. Whether it is a traffic problem on the road, you will find that the other person will show you the middle finger if you had perhaps driven a bit too much over the white line on the other side or whatever. Petty little things, but which seems to indicate the level of violent behavior in society. And, Chair, whilst we need to attend to what we have in our centers, we need to start working urgently on preventative matters. And I want to just say this, Chair. I was 18 years old when I did something wrong. And my father locked me in a room and he brought out the shambok. And, of course, I was full of wheels after that hiding I got. And for an hour or two, I felt I've got the most cruel father, but today I say he was the most loving one. May God bless him. So, Chair, spoil the rod and spare the child. We have unfortunately done away with the rod. Might be time to perhaps have a rethink, Chair. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'm just quite concerned with Mr. Mofeti's submission here today that, I just want perhaps the committee or the department to say to us, it appears if they're saying that a model of the seven-day establishment and the two shifts, it's not working, it has collapsed. And my reason for saying that, it appears also that at any given point, there seem to be 25% of staff present on, and specifically on sections. We have found with our oversight that we find one person, a woman, alone on a section doing work, security work, which is incredibly dangerous, I think, for the woman. I'm asking, and I hear now also the minister is saying perhaps we should review it. Perhaps we should really have, and perhaps this committee needs to get some kind of model, alternative model, and not only for the World Cup, Mr. Chair, but I think we also see that programs, rehabilitation programs, can't take place because there are no people to do the security part of it. I'm asking the department to please, let us look at some model that will work. It seems as if this one doesn't work. I know with the World Cup, everyone is going to probably be at the World Cup. There's no one going to be, I mean, no officials will be at prison. So I'm just making the point. Perhaps we just need to ask the department whether there's any alternative model, staffing model, that will work and that will be able to accommodate not only the World Cup, but continuously.
Thank you. Excuse me. Thank you, sir. No, I think, Mr. Moketsi, you probably were correct when you started by saying we're on the same side and we seem to have the same concerns. So I'll just summarize them. I really don't think there needs to be too much to's and fro's, but if you want to respond later on, you want to. Clearly the first concern that we have together with you is the, if we could call it, the unintended consequences of the 7-day two-shift establishment, and that we might all have to review them. I can indicate that our hearings prior to the budget, this matter was raised by the organized labor, certainly PSA raised, that maybe there was not too much preparation in it. So I do think that all of us together need to sit and do an objective evaluation of the unintended consequences and how we fix them up. The more immediate one is to ensure that the issues raised by Mamungweni of the possibility of people extending their leave or sick leave or whatever you want to call it, especially during the World Cup, is something that as a department you might want to just look at. It's just a comment from our side, but that's a concern that we raised there. And then the issues, you know, Mr. Fischler has raised these issues consistently since I've come here. And I do know that there might be constraints because of the facilities that we have. But are you giving serious thought to trying to separate first-time offenders or the vulnerable from the hardened criminal? Are you trying to do that? I think there's merit in that argument. Of course, the limitations would be facilities and so on. But I do think there's merit in that argument. So if indeed you subscribe to that view, but the limitations are because of the infrastructure, maybe you need to raise it so that from our side as well, because it seems to be an agreement from the committee side, we then assist you. If you don't subscribe to it, of course, we need to talk more so that we convince each other one way or the other. But I do think there's a bit of merit in the arguments raised by Mr. Fischer. You take a vulnerable, and then somebody raised it. You pretty boys are the ones that get abused by gangsters and so on. And yet we continue doing those types of things. Is it because we don't have the facilities? Is it because we don't subscribe to it? A waiting trial might be a bit more difficult because of just the overcrowding. And then I agree, and I think you agree at the department, I certainly know that the ministry agrees that the challenges of society have to be brought onto the agenda. It's not a correctional services issue. All of us need to go out and say, to win this battle, society has to be brought on board. I recall, I mean, and just to indicate that we're having a public hearing on the 26th of May to begin this thing, because we do know, we've been saying that inmates must be kept busy, but we know that some amongst you will turn around and say that we are slave drivers. Others amongst you might turn around and say they deserve it. So we are beginning this dialogue that says society must begin to also take responsibility. Because ultimately all these individuals, or certainly 99% of them in our lifetime, are going to re-enter society. So as a committee, we're starting the public dialogue around how do we entertain these notions of society taking responsibility, that inmates are not on holiday and so on. So I really think there is agreement on all those things with the department. If you really want to comment, maybe it will be just on the unintended consequences of the 7 days, and if there's anything you're doing about it, and also on Mr. Fischler's suggestions about separating vulnerable groups. And do you subscribe? Are the challenges or the limitations, infrastructure? Is there anything that we can do as a team, all of us, if we indeed subscribe to it? Because the committee certainly subscribes to at least the theory of trying to separate first-time offenders from the hardened criminals.
Chair, it's not so much of a response, but just to clarify the issue. And in doing that, I don't want to take anything away from the summary that you have made. The problem that you are considering, which is what you are also considering, is not per se the 7 days. At its best, 7 days says Department of Correctional Services should work from Monday to Sunday. At its best, that's what it says. But there is no problem per se around that issue. The problem arises around the shift. And so I do want us to separate those two issues. Because 7 days is good, but the shift is a matter of permutations. Which one can you use to optimize the utilization of staff and to limit consequences that you're seeing are unintended? And I think that discussion we must have and continue evaluating that process. The second issue, Chair, is the issue I think that Ms. Ngonya is raising. I want to make a plea to yourself, Chair, that let's be deliberate in separating 2010 related issues from the issues of security generally, because we may crowd them and draw a link which may not necessarily, we may draw a cause and effect which may not necessarily be there. And so I was going to suggest even that you move directly into the 2010 part of the discussion, and I'll go to the gangs issues later. I think the issue of separation, we note it, Chair, it's not easy. Part of it is what to say around the facilities. But it's not a simple matter of a first-time offender vis-a-vis hardcore, because a first-time offender might actually be a very serious problem person, might have been committing crime for the last 15 years or what one knows. But the unfortunate thing being that he was not caught around that time. So it's not... I think it can relate to the issues of age, which we have done. It can relate to the issues of assessing a person such that the end result of that, you have a sense of vulnerabilities, and you separate people based on their vulnerabilities, the commonalities of issues and so on, which I think our classification tool does. It may not be perfect, and of course, to that extent, we can have that discussion around what the classification tool does and how does it work. We can have that discussion, but I really do want to say it's not the first time vis-a-vis the hardcore. It's a very difficult mix. So to that extent, Chair, I want to acknowledge the points. We should actually acknowledge the points made. But if you allow us, just move into 2010 and then talk to the issues there.
Okay.
Chairperson, thanks. The department is represented in the different committees, local committees as well as the JCPS structures. Now, what we have done in the host cities, we have identified a correctional center. If there's any influx from the police cells, then we can utilize the space in those facilities in those centers. But we were, in the meetings that we have attended with the SAPS, it says that we will not anticipate an undue overflow of people that commit 2010 related crimes. But if it's not 2010 related crimes, people will be dealt with in the normal judicial system. Now, this is also very much part of the general government plan to deal with these incidences within a 24-hour cycle. And what we have considered within these days, within the task team, is that there's a contingency plan. And the contingency plan will therefore identify certain things that needs to be done. In the first place, the department will not give the normal leave of staff during this period. So that the bulk of the staff will be available. So that's a communication that's already been out and circulated in the regions. Secondly, we will utilize the stringent measures like we normally do around the festive season, where you allow minimum movement of offenders. No span duties so that people go out. We will arrange with the courts that during this period specifically, that minimum movement should take place and transfers offenders, that we have a lockdown situation during the 2010 period. And then for emergency support teams will be on standby, the ESD teams, in terms of if there's any emergency to deal with it there on the spot. That's now our internal ESD teams, as well as the dog and mounted units in support to the different centers. So there's no state of readiness. There will be a situation where staff will not be given leave unnecessary. The minimum staff, and then there must be a motivation around it for this period. No movement, in fact, of offenders, so that we also minimize the movement of offenders around that period and only allow essential services to continue, like the agriculture section, where you have animals, they still need to be fed during that period. So that will continue as essential services around that period.
Chairperson, the essence of what you are saying, and this is a broader argument, that there will generally be your kind of 2010 type of crimes, which will be dealt with constantly over a 24-hour period through the criminal justice system. Our expectations are that any one of these things will happen around the whole city. To that extent, every single one of the people that will be involved in those sort of crimes will be held in the holding facility somewhere, either around the stadium or in the police cells, and not in the correctional services facilities. We then make a provision as correctional services. In the event of an overflow, which is not anticipated, in the event of an overflow, around the whole cities, we have got bigger facilities there, we'll move inmates out and create excess capacity for those specific people in collaboration with the police so that they then move into those specific facilities. The sense is that any decision around any particular person will have been taken within the 24-hour period. What is excluded here is a person who is a visitor but is involved in drug trafficking. That's a normal crime, and so you follow the normal process of the law. So it's not a 2010-related crime by general definition. But the essence within the criminal justice system is that those people will be dealt with, found guilty, they will be immediately deported. And there will be no crisis that is resident with correctional services, unless you are part of your normal crime type of situation. So to the extent that correctional services is involved, and I'm saying, to the extent of our involvement is limited primarily to the areas of host cities. And so we should have adequate capacity to concentrate it towards the areas of need. And so our contingency plans will make adequate provision for those sorts of things. So there is that sort of distinction, which does not necessarily, in the first instance, make correctional services the immediate response, but justice and subs are the immediate respondent to the 2010 related issues. But we provide extra capacity to them. And to the extent that we do, we are ready today. And I think a space of 300 offenders in every one of the host cities is way too much than we will expect. From where we sit as correctional services, our problem around 2010 is not necessarily around the people that arrive on the 11th of June to 11th of July. Our problem may result in period before that, which will not affect the people who are visiting here for purposes of 2010. The period before that and the period after that, in the event that there are opportunistic crime, when those people get arrested, that's a threat, but we're not getting that signal yet. There is no sense in which our statistics demonstrate that there is an increase in the inflow on July, which we did not anticipate. So at the moment as we speak, there isn't a sense of threat, but we are not oblivious to a possibility. And so we are ready to deal with those issues as and when they arise. Thank you.
No, thank you very much. Gives us a bit of comfort. My small concern that I have, and it's just a small concern, Mr. Diamonds and yourself, Mr. Moketsi, continually talk about 2010-related crimes. And from where I'm sitting, I understand that to be crimes that would be in and around the stadium itself. But, you know, the reality is that if you went to any of our constituencies, on a Friday, all the police stations overflow the cells. Now, they overflow because people are urinating or people have been drinking in public, in the parks, and so on. So it's not at the stadium. But because there would be so many festivities, in inverted commas, it might just have that impact. And I'm not sure, Mr. Moketsi, that the SAPS have the ability to process those things in 12 hours, or 24 hours, as you indicated, which is an ideal and a good situation. So I'm saying, we are comfortable and we are happy, but those are the things that maybe in your interactions with the rest of the task team just bring to the fore. It might not be correctional services specific, but we do know that on a Monday, after the courts close, trucks and trucks of people leave the courts to go to our facilities because Vincent doesn't have 50 rand to pay bail for urinating in the park. So it does have a knock-on effect. But we are comfortable with that approach. So can I suggest then that in the same vein, we've got an hour left, if you could then present whatever else you need to present, we'll engage with that, come up with some sort of concrete steps, and we can take it from there, and then also allow the inspecting judge's office to contribute to one or two of these things if you feel that you need to contribute to them. So you'll be afforded an opportunity to contribute when we open it up. Can the department then conclude with its presentation, and then we'll open up for a broader discussion?
Chairperson, the next area that you'd want to cover was the indicators for these, but I'm not sure should we go to the gangs immediately.
That's what's the gang.
Chairperson, that's now page 24 of the presentation. We are asking ourselves the question, where and why are these gang activities within the correctional center? On slide 24, we are giving the different incidences that took place over the past year, financial year 2009-2010. And gang violence then happen as stabbing incidences. Gang fights mostly take place during the day outside cells and dining areas, courtyards, walking, passages, etc. And I think the statistics are well known that during these incidences, also either inmates die in the process, as well as staff or inmates get injured during that process. So we have recorded over the past financial year 295 incidences of gangs. Now, the information around gangs are not readily available because of the secrecy of gangsters. They swore secrecy to the different gang leaders. There's elements of intimidation among gangs. There's fear tactics among gangs. And because of that, not all the incidences of gangs are being reported to DC's officials. Now, we have gathered this information in terms of the risk. There's a risk committee within DCA, and this risk committee manages the different risk areas within the department. And this is one of the areas that's being monitored by a risk committee that is reporting then to the executive of the department to look at interventions and timely decisions on it. Now, mostly gang activities occur around KwaZulu-Natal, Eastern Cape, Gauteng, and the Western Cape. The other provinces are quite manageable, and you don't hardly hear about the gang activities in those areas. Now, there's an element of sexual violence and rape also among these gang activities. And that also is underreported, not always come to the fore and be reported to the DCS officials. Now, the gang violence involves sexual abuse and rape occur mostly in communal cells after lockup. That's happening inside cells. And it's a debatable issue, the fact that we can consider CCTV cameras with inside communal cells. Now, we are working with the CSIR on projects to look at how can we utilize technology to assist us in curbing some of these things inside facilities. Now, we have an anti-gang strategy that was developed with external role players involved in this process. The inspecting judge was also part of this very first roundtable discussion, and we have developed the strategy with an action plan that we have made available to the different regions. Now, in terms of short-term actions, there's a continuous risk assessment, supervision, and separation of vulnerable offenders. There's an increased access control and movement control and searching that's taking place. That's currently what's happening inside facilities. We are also encouraging the reporting of victimization and bullying amongst of offenders. And we also, as a department, render support to victims of violence. And there's strict enforcement of disciplinary and criminal procedures. And we provide also inmates now on admission with accurate information in terms of their rights and responsibilities. Now, what the strategy also then indicated was that on medium term and longer term, we still have to improve in terms of these different areas. Staff training needs to be improved on so that we can recognize and understand the different forms of violence, coercion, abuse, and threats. The risk assessment needs to be understood. Self-harm, suicide associated with gang coercion, the effective handling of complaints, conflict resolution, dealing with incidents of violence, presenting alternatives to reasons for inmates involved in gangs, and we need to establish a structure and database at all levels to identify and collect information on gangs. And then we need to fully implement the sentence plan and development plan for offenders. These areas are highlighted in terms of the strategy that it still needs improvement and staff needs to be trained on these areas. Slide 28, also as part of the strategy, indicates that there's programs which need to address inmate personal safety, sexual and reproductive health, gender sexuality, health, and constructive coping mechanisms amongst inmates. And then we need to continue research good practices in respect of prevention, code enforcement, and victim support. And these are some of the areas that's been highlighted. Now, we have a behavior modification program on gangsterism, and the attendance of this program is now compulsory if it's part of the correctional sentence plan of a particular offender. Now, that program has been implemented now recently. Now, the purpose of this program is to prevent newly admitted offenders from joining gangs, as well as those already gang members to change their behavior. And the program also focuses on the different sessions presented by trained correctional intervention officials, and those areas that have been covered in terms of those sessions as gangsters and reasons for it, consequences, and coping within a correctional center. So, in fact, we have a strategy, we have a plan. That has not been presented to the portfolio committee currently because the commissioner has signed it off recently. And that consultation is indicated by the commissioner still needs to take place. And we use the documents now currently as working documents so that the consultation can be broadened to include all three of the society so they can contribute to the strategy.
Chair, if you'll allow me, I just want to raise three issues which I think are critical to your attention and issues which I also think will forever need guidance and assistance on. One is that the recent phenomena on our part around issues of gangs is our observation that they evolve. So your typical 28 and the cultures and whatever it is that they feel they have to do, those things are so much not almost the primary issues that much anymore. The presence, I mean, when you look at our classification, you'll see that economic crimes come third almost in an order of prevalence. And so you have inmates within our facilities that are somewhat resourced. Not that they have got money, but that they can reward in different other forms. And so, terrified as they are within the correctional facility, they discover an environment of gangster. And so there's a coexistence between people that will otherwise have been arrested, a syndicate, with whatever, and finding gangs there. And so with the resources that they have, manipulating the workings of the gangs for their own direct satisfaction. So this adds a different dimension to the operations of gang within our facility. I'm saying the changing profile of our inmates has got a coinciding effect to the gang such that it becomes an issue of a security threat on its own alone. So it constitutes an observation on our part. The second issue is the issue I think Mr. Diamonds was raising. I want to phrase it differently to say there is an issue of privacy here that we need to protect, the privacy of individual offenders vis-à-vis the need to provide security. And this is where the issue of video cameras inside the cells comes in. And we are debating this issue about whether or not which right supersedes which one. Because they've got an obligation to provide protection, but we do not have adequate means to find out exactly what happens there. We are fully aware that people are coerced. And so it is not adequate that in the morning we say, what is your complaint? Because there are consequences to you speaking. And so the impression we live with is that there are no complaints here. But it could very well be that somebody was victimized during the night and so on. So, and hence the issue of our responsibility to provide security and therefore the utilization of video cameras vis-à-vis the privacy of individuals. It's a very important issue to deal with. But, Chair, lastly, in most of the instances where our staff have been involved in assault, in most of the incidences, when you investigate this thing, you find that it has something to do with the gangs. And so you have a situation where staff either are involved directly in a direct conflict, and therefore they use force in a situation where if they don't, the likelihood of them being seriously hurt is so high. And so the margins of force that our staff use, which could potentially be excessive, and here I'm not justifying incidences where our staff have ultimately killed offenders. It's unacceptable. But you're caught up in a crossfire of a fight between two gangs, and they have found ways of developing instruments that did not necessarily have capacity at that moment to respond to. And so the level of force that you use at some point becomes excessive. An element of it is this, which is what I think Mr. Amons is saying. The leaders of gangs are never involved in this fight. But we know that they are the ones that issued the instructions. And they are a distance away. There are consequences to members that do not carry out instructions of gang leaders. And so you end up at some point through an investigation finding out that the person who was totally away from the scene has somewhat been a victim of our response. And then the question arises, are you victimizing these people or what? And so on. But none of the people that were involved in that gang activity will ever confess that it was so and so who gave these instructions. It's just a very, very, I want to emphasize this point, it's just a very secretive society. And at no stage will any one of the members that have shown to that, at no stage will any one of them divulge. The sense I get is that they will rather die than tell you. But at some point through our information, we know who the actual person who issued that instruction has been. So, Chair, I'm raising these issues for your attention just to demonstrate that at some point you may raise an issue with us. You raised an issue with us around your corp at one point. Inmates going on hunger strike and so on. At that point, we know that the intention is not so much about whether or not, I can't remember what the problem was, but we know at that point that the intention is to gain access to a corridor so that at some future date they can attack other members elsewhere. To you, they present a problem. They are refusing to meet with us, which was the case in Lyokop. The area commissioner there simply knew that I'm dealing with an issue of gangs here. But letters are all over the show, complaining about something completely unrelated. So I'm really saying to you that we may sound insensitive sometimes, but at a point when we're dealing with a specific matter of security concern, it becomes difficult for us to respond to an issue. People are on hunger strike. They are on hunger strike, but we simply know that it's a gang-related activity. And so the pressure on us is to deal with the hunger strike, and that pressure is oblivious to the fact that we're dealing with an issue of gangs here. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Moseki. I think one of the solutions, because you're quite correct, that letters will come to my office talking about something else. I think one of the solutions is this type of dialogue. Well, I'll say to you, please, have you got a different version of what's happening in Lyokop to the letter that I've received? And we have that discussion before we put extra pressure on you. I think that's the route we need to go. We do send to the department through Mamelo every letter that we receive. So I think we would need to have that discussion. But I think, sir, you, when you said that this is a very secretive society, I think you re-emphasize certainly my biasness towards the debate of conflicting rights. You see, I don't think that I should be looking at somebody who dehumanizes another human being, who abuses another human being, and then say we cannot put cameras in there because of his human rights. This is my personal view. And I think we need to debate that matter. For me, it's not debatable. It helps us in a whole host of other things, because half of the stuff we were discussing here, somebody committed suicide at the bin or somewhere nobody knew about. I mean, so many things happen that nobody knows about. And I'm arguing that I'd rather fight to the bitter end for having surveillance and technology in the cells than for somebody to say to me that I'm maybe stretching his own human rights. That's my personal view on that matter. So I do think that we need to have those discussions. You see why Mr. or the department, maybe. You know, I come from an area that for our sins have a very high population of people that have visited your facility. Very high population. Probably one in every second house where I come from has that. And all of us know who the generals are in the prisons. doesn't matter which prison it is, Mother B, wherever. I could take you and we'd be able to say, so-and-so is a general, so-and-so did that. I can take you. So everybody knows about it. We also know that somebody goes in and becomes a Vaifi. But you turn around and correctly so say that none of them would ever say it for the consequences. I'm saying technology would be such that he doesn't even have to say it. And I'm saying we could build an argument that says, let's stop the dehumanizing of people. The third point that I'd want to raise around this matter is, again, and I'm taking it from my own constituency, home where I grew up. You know, I don't know, but every now and then, a wave of inmates come out, because we would all have been arrested at the same time for our activities. So you'll find next year, all the fast guns are coming out, or all the Spaldings are coming out, type of thing. Now, I don't know if they're coming out on parole, or coming out on having served their term. I want to say that if anybody is a known gangster in terms of the 26th and the 27th, why can't we argue that that person should forfeit his parole rights? Because he comes out of there on parole and from the outside continues to control the gangs even inside. Now these are real things that are happening in our constituency. So we're not going to have solutions now. I don't think we're asking you for answers now. But I do think the more we discuss and the more we share what's happening on the ground, the better it is for all of us to develop an anti-gang strategy that is meaningful. It might be meaningful in your environment there, but it doesn't solve all these other questions that we're talking about that happens on the ground in Westbury, that happens all over the show. So we're opening a dialogue, I think. I don't think we're looking for answers. I think what we need to do is to begin to populate this or to have a brainstorming session where your anti-gangsterism strategy is reinforced so that when it is applied, it has an impact. Those are the issues. Those are all just comments that I made that need to be considered. But let's start on this side going for this round. We will then take, seems like everybody wants to speak, we'll start with Mr. Fritz. And time is really against us, and if we can be slightly to the point, but we'll go from Mr. Fritz all the way to Mr. Abra.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I think you just raised a very important point around, and Mr. Motseki's comments he made is incredibly enlightening. The fact that you're saying the evolving nature of prison gangs, very, very, I think, fascinating stuff, really research stuff. The point I just quickly want to make, Mr. Chair, I think, and I know the classification of particular prisons like Kokstad is a maximum security, but if you look at the stats on what number of assaults there are, whether there are any gangs, whether, I mean, you will find nothing. I just want to make a comment around the relation between architecture and gang activity, and I think you mentioned the issue of communal self, and I really think we need to go and visit and revisit and review of our whole conception of architecture. This idea of the Kimberley new prisons with 10 people in the community, I think we should stop it. We should really go for single self with a new four-generation prison coming up. And I think that's going to contribute to limiting the power of the gangs, to really reduce incidences of gang activity and of, as you say, subsequent rape in prisons, etc., etc. I really think we need to make a very, very strong, and I want to make a plea that we really look, when we do the four new generation prisons, that we look at the architecture of those prisons to stop the whole notion of gang and rape in our prisons. Thank you.
Mr. Major.
Thank you, Chair. Chairperson, maybe the challenge that we are facing now, we have lived this stigma for a long time. Why we're allowing our center to have this gang called 2526? What was the motive of that? Where does this 25 and 26 come from? I think, Chairperson, we need to make a strong campaign together with the department instead of stopping this gangster, because we have lived this thing long time. You remember when we go to oversight, there was a site where the head of the prison didn't want us to go. And I insisted that, no, why are you blocking us? I wanted to go there. Then you said I must go. On that site, there was a cell only for Sodoma and Gomorrah. And the center knows that these cells are the cells that is for Sodoma and Gomorrah. Why are we allowing that happen at the first place? So, Chair, I agree with you that we need to have debate on this. Because we've lived this thing of 25-26. I'm sure Nam Sakula, I heard about this 25 and 26. And nothing, nobody, no one wanted to interfere to stop this 25 and 26. I think now this is the time for us, all of us, to work on this 25 and 26 to come to an end in our center. Secondly, Chairperson, when you read the page 31, shows that the stats shows that HIV is high among inmates in KZN. However, Chair, you may ask yourself that if a KZN got high statistics, but when you look at page 31, Western Cape experience also high accident of sexual violence and rape in correctional centers. So, Chair, my question will be, what is the statistics for HIV and AIDS among offenders in the Western Cape? Another question, Chair. The presentation states that among the measure of deal with sexual violence is to take victim to the safe place. Okay. We're talking about security here. What will be safe place means in this regard? Department must answer that. Mr. Mseki, touch a little bit about the vetting of officials. let me not go to the page, but focus on my question. Chair, I want to know which occupation level position are these two officials who are vetted for top secret. Can Mr. Museki provide a breakdown of level of vented officials? The 2008 and 9 report, Chair, annual report of the department shows that DCS had a total of 39 top management and 131 senior management of these numbers. How many of these people in the department have been vetted? Thank you, Chair.
Chair, I'll confine myself from this from page 24 to page 28. That is against the gangsterism is a phenomenon that has been in existence for more than 100 years in the West. And it was created
because of the type of justice that was happening, that's the type of retributive justice. You know, there was a time when there was a term, they call it in prison, when we were there, we call it carry on. When there's violence, when they find that there's been some violence in a cell, the wardens will come with batons and dogs and start beating all those prisoners, beating them. They call it carry on. Then later on, they have to be stopped. Now, gangsterism was created because of the violence that was imparted on them by the wardens at one time. So it was sort of trying to survive and protecting themselves. And it has come to stay, not only here in South Africa, right through the West. Now, you find these are the types of prisoners, of gangsters. You got 28, got 27, got 26, and you got desperados, you get big fights, you got flyers. Now, if these flyers are those sophisticated types, those who plan to escape in prison, they plan to escape, go out of prison. Then you got desperados and big fights. It's those now that fight, that sort of want to have a better way of better life, and then by informing against the big fight, against the 26 and 28. Now these are the types of prisoners, gangsters that are in existence. They have been in existence for many, many years, for decades, right through the world. Now, in some countries, what they do, they try to separate them, take them to other prisons. If there's a group of 28 that are dominating in this prison, you separate them, take them, just strip them to various types of prisons. But it's, of course, the problem is that in many of these prisons, they will always find other 28s in other prisons. So that's one problem that you get. But in South Africa, you see, the dominance of these 28 and 26 is in the Eastern Cape, in these maximum prisons like St. Alban Prison. You go to Western Cape, Portsmouth. You go to KwaZulu-Natal, Westville. So that these big maximum prisons. You go to Gauteng, you get these gangsters in existence. And they are there and they're controlling the prison inside, yeah, when the warders are not there. Now, the question of privacy, I don't think we can accept that. The mere fact that you say you have been arrested and all your rights have been taken away. The only right of a prisoner is that he must get food. He must get an exercise. He must get clothing. That is the right. That is their right. So all the other rights that they were having outside when they were not in prison have been taken away from them. The mere fact that they committed a crime. So you can't allow to say that, no, you can't put these CCTV cameras in a prison because he wants privacy. He has no privacy. The mere fact is that this question of security overrides everything. That why is this there? They must check what is happening in prison. Because warders cannot stay in a cell to watch what is happening. But they can use these cameras and to see what is actually happening. In so that when, because the problem is that the victims will not come out and tell the truth because they're going to beaten back when they come back and report them. So the best thing is that is the cameras. Then you will able to, we are going to be able to detect what has actually happened at night, because things happen at night when the cells are closed. So that is the problem of these gangsters dominating. Of course, they recruit. That's why I say people must not graduate in crime. Because once you go to prison, you graduate in crime. Yeah, that's one problem that is facing. Because you go there and you learn more about crime from the other hardened criminals. That's why you must be separated. You must not know anything. The youth must not know anything about crime. Yeah. They must only learn what they've done and not what the mistakes. Because what they do, they correct your mistake. They say, no, you make this and this and this. You should have done this and this and this. And then you graduate in crime. That's the one problem that they have. I think those are the points.
Thank you, Chairperson. I've got a concern concerning the CCTV. The center where I went, there are no CCTV. Barberton Maxima, there are no CCTV there. So my question is that the 26th and 28th, we had them in Barberton. I think Mr. Mzeki knows about it. But today we don't have them. I don't know what criteria did they use to not to have this 26 and 28. It was a big fight. They killed each other. More than 10 people died on the spot that day. Since that day, we don't have 28 and 26 in Barberton. People are moving anyhow. There's no such thing called 26 and 28. My other question is this medication overdose. I just wonder how come some inmates, they overdose themselves. Because even if you go to a doctor, he gives you the prescription and tells you that how many tablets must you take. And for that matter, in the centers, why do we give the inmates the more amount that he can even overdose himself? It is uncalled for. And my last one is this natural, the cause of death unknown. What I know, even if you are at home or in hospital, when you happen to pass on there, you go to the mortuary, there will be a postmortem. The district surgery who's there, he will diagnose what is the cause of the death. But here, it's the cause of the death is not, it's unknown why. Thank you, Chairperson.
Meneer Abraham?
Baie dankie, voorzitter. Slide 25, the last bullet, gang violence involving sexual abuse. Now, I take note that you are working with the CSIR to develop some other system. But this is not something that has happened overnight. I mean, it's been coming a long time. What are your immediate responses to this kind of activity while you are awaiting some or other development with the CSIR? The next slide, 26, short-term actions. Create an environment that encourages the reporting on victimization, bullying, and abuse. Now, that environment, is it still to be created? Has it already been created? What are your, how successful is that environment if it's already in operation? Strict enforcement of disciplinary and criminal procedures. How strictly have you enforced them? Because these are all supposed to be short-term actions. And what are the consequences and the results of that level of enforcement? Then we go on to slide number 28, where you say if you take the arrow and the bottom lot of, I don't know what to call them, they're not bullets, legislative provisions, come up with proposals. If you've got legislative provisions that need to be brought about, new ones, if the current legislative provisions do not suffice, I think it is part of the duty of the department's senior management to come forward with proposals, that we believe that the following proposals should be considered, so that they can then be discussed and channeled, and state law advisors can be requested to draft appropriate amendments to the legislation or whatever, if that is going to help us. The transfer of gangsters to maximum facilities. Now, I heard Mr. Motseki saying that, fine, the people will not talk, and of course, for their own safety, they will not talk. But then we are allowing people to run our prisons inside. We've just heard it now. Many of my colleagues have mentioned it. Now, the question here is, what are we going to do? You must come up with proposals. And we believe that we will have to remove gang leaders, put them on an island or whatever, or lock them up somewhere and forget the key or whatever. Come up with a proposal. Because, again, this has been happening for a long time. And we talk about it, but we're not coming up. And you are the people on the ground that know the problem. Why are you not coming up with proposals as to how to deal with this type of problem? We need to find a solution. On slide 30, you say that the official information system of DCS does not make provision for separate capturing of sexual violence and rape. I mean, sexual violence and rape is a major issue in our country today. I mean, next to murder, it's one of the other most major ones that assault the dignity of people. And we don't capture this. Why? Is it again a question of your current codes not permitting you to do so? If so, what have you done to have it changed? Chair, you say in the second last bullet, complicated matter, especially in differentiating between consensual and forced sex. Now, my comrade Baba Ben, our veteran here, has already said that you are not entitled to any special rights. Your basic right and the duty of the state is to provide you with a roof, provide you with food, and provide you with clothing. Those are the basic rights. Everything else is secondary. And here we are now saying that it's complicated. I mean, it is obvious that a person is being raped when that person shows those tendencies and complaints or whatever. And I find this very, very difficult, that we cannot differentiate between consensual and forced sex. I mean, nobody has the right to even have consensual sex inside the prison. They didn't come there to come and enjoy family life. They came there to repay back to society under humane conditions. That's what we would like to create for them, not special rights. Sexual violence and rapes are a reality in DCS facilities, and condoms are provided as a health precautionary measure. This boggles the mind. I mean, you see, Chair, the problem here is, when 12-year-old girls get pregnant, we are so liberal in our legislation, we decide, no, we must now bring the age of termination of pregnancy down from 18 to 12 years. How we say here that because this is a reality, no, vrachtag, let's give them condoms. No, sir, we can't run a facility of this nature by pandering to the whims and fancies of people who have a debt to repay to society. Finally, Chair, you say here strategies to deal with sexual violence and rape on slide 32. It's the first four blocked one. Clear definition of terms, e.g. consensual versus forced sex. I don't know, Chair, I think we must have a debate on this and decide whether our services, our facilities are actually dead for the purposes of consensual sex. I mean, Chair, you take, for example, a communal cell where this type of thing takes place. It does not take place naturally in a single cell. Are you saying that where there are 20, 30 inmates, or even 15, 20, or even more than two, that you're going to allow this kind of thing to take place, Jack. No, Comrade Winnie just spoke about the Sodom and Gomorrans. If they want to have that, and I say, well, let's create a little island for them somewhere there in the prison grounds, I'm actually now taking it too far to do whatever they want to do. But we are not going to encourage that kind of thing. So, Chair, please, there are some answers that the department must come up with, because ons kan nie so aangaan nie, Chair. We must not accept something as inevitable. The only thing that's inevitable is the day of judgment. It is inevitable, it's going to happen. Everything else which is human created is possible to change, Chair. And we cannot accept that these things cannot be done. Thank you very much, Chair.
All right. We'll allow the department to respond, but before we do that, we'll ask Mr. Morris. We'll give you 5 minutes. We're about to wrap up. But then in your input, both of you, clearly there are some matters that are for debate rather than for you to respond. Maybe the policy as it stands says that. But clearly there are some matters that we're going to, as this committee, drive. I mean, the issues, whether we agree with them or disagree with them now, doesn't stop debate. The issues of conceptual sex in a cell, for instance, almost by definition means that it is right. And then you get somebody that has done nothing, doesn't get conjugal rights. So, you know, it's those things that we're talking about. We shouldn't, by default, almost legitimize something. It's illegitimate, but we almost say, well, it happens, therefore we legitimize it. I'm saying those are not necessary for you to respond to, Ms. Schreiner, but those are debates that we're going to have at this committee, at those levels. So I don't expect you to respond to that now, but if you want to contribute to the discussion, you can contribute to the discussion. I'm not sure who's here. I'm talking about from outside, but I would ask you, talking about NGOs or interested people that might be here, let's start the debate. Let's start this debate. Is it wrong for us to be saying that these things must be debated and we have certain views on them? Is it wrong for us to be saying that, you see, I will never support your right to privacy over the right of dehumanizing somebody? I'm talking about the CCTVs. But it's something that we must open up for discussion. So those of us that are here that are outside of the portfolio committee, outside of the department, we're encouraging you to put your comments and your thoughts on paper. Let us begin this discussion, because we have to have it sooner rather than later. And also, Mr. Morris, you would need to raise those issues. So there's some that are political. There is a societal responsibility that we must all start discussing. Others are operational or administrative that you can start responding to, like the prevalence of HIV in Western Cape, the types of issues. I would expect some responses on those matters. Mr. Morris, the reason we call you is because you are independent, and therefore are expected to give us a view without any intimidation from the department or anybody else. So we'd want you, you've now stepped through this 2 hour very productive discussion. We'd want you to summarize all the things that we've been discussing from your own point of view. The prevalence or the exaggeration from our side, or the underplaying from our side, or the underplaying from the department side. One thing we're going to do as this committee is to make a difference in correctional services. One thing we're going to do is to make a difference. And we can't make a difference unless we get objective views from yourselves, and that is why we're asking people outside of these two entities to start the debate around the issues that we've raised. So we'd want you to make that input and respond to some of these questions if you need to respond to them, and then we'll ask Jenny and her team to do so. 12 o'clock or shortly thereafter, we need to move on to the next agenda item. The other issue that maybe has not been raised here, Jenny and Mr. Mutek, is, and I mean, you might have raised it earlier, you might have responded to it earlier on. I keep on hearing this phrase of sexual violence and rape. What is the difference between sexual violence and rape in the context of correctional facilities? Or is it one thing? You know, it's just a question that I'm asking. Mr. Morris, you've got about 5 minutes, sir, to add to the discussions and debates we have. The department will have about 5 minutes to respond and to their closing remarks. And then... Oh, Mr. Morris, between the two of you, not necessarily, I won't limit it to who, but I'm saying that office must... Mr. Raja from that, yeah, the office of the inspecting judge, I'm not fussy about which one responds, but you guys have got a few minutes to contribute.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and yes, I'm joined by Mr. Raga, who is our National Manager of Legal Services. Mr. Chair, thanks also for the opportunity to listen to the intellectual debate that have taken place this morning, because I really believe that this also helps us to ensure that from the side of the Judicial Inspectorate, our services are aligned with the needs that exist in this committee and within the department. So because with the limited resources at our disposal, not only ourselves but other departments as well, we need to make sure that our resources are directed to those areas where it's most needed in order that we can ensure that we have the best results. Moving on to the issue of violence in prisons, and at the risk of stating the obvious, Mr. Chair, I would like to start by underlying the fact that violence in prisons is not an isolated issue. It is strongly linked to the other problems that exist within correctional services, as highlighted by the honourable members of the committee, like staff shortages and budgets and infrastructure and overcrowding. So therefore, when we start looking at violence, I do believe that there's a holistic approach is needed. Mr. Abrams also asked us what are our suggestions on the table. I'll get there very briefly now, but I think we need to just reflect on our strategies thus far in reducing incidents of violence. Now, I also believe, Mr. Chair, that we are under severe pressure with our strategy of investigating and reporting cases of violence, because the rate at which these events are perpetrated or happen far exceed our capacity to investigate and report on the incidents. And as a result, our independent visitors are increasingly under pressure amongst the inmates themselves, because they're losing credibility. Inmates are accusing them of becoming institutionalized and not doing anything. And the reason for that, Mr. Chair, is that it's not they that are ineffective. You can look at their reports. They report these issues all the time. It's the response to the reports that are inefficient. It's not the fact that we don't investigate, but we feel it's the response to our reports that is the area of inefficiency. And that is really putting us under a lot of pressure in order to adopt this strategy to reduce the incidence of violence. We have also seen recently, Mr. Chair, that there is a strong a causal link between the build-up of frustration amongst the inmate population and the incidence of violence. Now, before I go there, Mr. Chair, I just want a bit of a commercial break. I've been involved in correctional services, as you may know, for 26 years now. And we've had violence in our prisons forever. But there is a big difference between the violence that we see now and the violence that we saw prior to 94. Before 94, our inmates were fighting against the system of racial segregation, of forced labor, etc. Now inmates are fighting for the system. They're actually fighting for their rights as outlined in the Act, as outlined in the Constitution, as outlined in the White Paper. They're not fighting against the system. They are actually fighting for the implementation of the system. Now, that's an important perspective, in my view, Mr. Chair, because it also then moves back to what do we need to do, in our opinion, to address violence. Again, I want to underline that there is no quick fixes. There is no simple solutions to this problem. We strongly believe that the Portfolio Committee has a very important role to play here, and they've already started in that. And we believe, Mr. Chair, the starting point should be a better alignment between the budget and the white paper and the Act. I think that's the starting point. If the committee wants the department to protect inmates, they must make sure that the money that's available is allocated for that purpose. Because as long as the budget is not aligned with the white paper and our strategic plans, we're not going to see change on operational level. The second one, Mr. Chair, we strongly support your initiative and that of the committee to get inmates involved in work. Not only work, but also programs, rehabilitation programs, recreation programs, because it was said by many a speaker this morning that idleness is a problem. They said it's the cushion of the devil. But we really need to get the inmates out of their cells where they currently spend, and I heard Mr. Dalmans also speak about the strategy of a lock-up for the June-July month. And I wish to raise our concern, Mr. Chair, because the lock-up basically means that an inmate is only allowed out of his cell to go and collect his meals. And the problem, and we've seen it many December, many festive seasons before. It's worked before. But our concern is that that is the situation almost since November last year. Most of our inmates are almost under conditions of lock-up for 23 hours a day since November last year, because of the two-shift system and the staff shortages. So to prolong this process, we need to be very mindful of the risk and the causal link that exists between build-up of frustration and acts of violence. Mr. Chair, then after also to add to what we need to do, of course, is the alignment of the budget. Secondly, we strongly believe that we need to get the inmates busy in work programs. And thirdly, Mr. Chair, is giving effect to Section 3, Subsection 2 of the Department of the Correctional Services Act, which basically states that the department must be run according to business principles. This committee needs to start measuring absenteeism rates. You need to start measuring production levels, and management must be able to account for those issues. Otherwise, we really, a lot of resources is wasted at the end of the day. And then lastly, Mr. Chair, in terms of our suggestion, is that we also believe, and it was said by Acting Commissioner Schreiner, in terms of the complaints procedure. I do believe, Mr. Chair, that an independent, reliable complaints procedure will protect inmates, and it will also reduce gang membership, because inmates belong to gangs because they feel threatened, because they have nobody to go to with their complaints, because they are not assisted when they need blankets, etc. So we believe that a strong, independent complaints procedure, and very importantly, the reaction to those complaints being laid, is very important in the strategy. If I may, Mr. Chair, just also briefly make comments on the issue of the CCTV cameras in the cells, if I may. Mr. Chair, we are concerned that I think it will work, you understand, because a CCTV camera will simply be covered by an inmate. You understand, how do we, we'll have to look at technology that will be able to withstand the cleverness of the inmates as well. And we've seen, for instance, windows are being covered. And again, it's an operational and a management problem. Technology in that case, we'll have to be very careful in going down that route. Also maybe have a pilot or two looking at the incident. There was a lot of comments made about our reports, Mr. Chair, on debt. And also what we have done, as you may know, since January this year, and especially 2009 as well, we are now confirming each and every day independently from the reports of correctional services. And we are submitting to the Minister and to your committee at interim reports on all so-called preventable or deaths or unnatural deaths. And we are also then using our independent prison visitors or independent correctional center visitors to verify the nature of the death in each and every case through a system of records of consultation. I don't know, Mr. Ravi, you want to add something?
Say it, sir. Don't say it, so
sure.
That you're on the record.
Sure. Thank you, Chairperson. Just one comment in the limited time we have. All the problems that have been raised here, I think my view is that we have the legislative provision. I think we can all agree. We have the regulations, we have what the so-called B orders. And I think the real challenge is its implementation and its monitoring. One example I give you, and is that since 1 November last year, when the Amendment Act came into operation, the use of force became a mandatory reportable incident in our centres. To date, and I don't mean this as over criticism, but I think if I count on my two hands, if we've received 10 reports from centres on the use of force. And of course, the use of force is incidental to sexual violence, EST raids, et cetera, force kind of pervades throughout all of those examples I've given. One concern, and we have raised this with our independent visitors, and I suppose, again, it's a challenge in the symbiotic relationship with the CCS, for the department to issue directives to monitor the lack of compliance on the face of it with the use of force. One last issue I want to raise, and this probably raised in our previous annual reports with regard to, and I don't talk about management, but I talk about management monitoring what happens on the ground, is that we've noticed, I'll talk about the sections. Of course, we don't have something called solitary confinement anymore from the 1st of October last year. We do have something called segregation for the purposes of discipline. Again, if you look at some of our reports, and these would indicate that very few disciplinary processes against inmates have been reported. I make the general statement, we can obviously break it down, but if one looks at compliance with that statutory provision, Section 25, previously and now Section 30, I think one of the challenges between our office and the department, again, would be to ensure that inmates, where they are, where they infringe rules, which is contained in the Act, are actually disciplined. The only conclusion we can make is that either they're not being reported, or the types of processing of infringement is more informal than formal. And I think, you know, when I make those statements, see the thread running through the incidents of sexual violence and assaults and all of those kind of things, my own view, which can be corroborated, would be that if we're not using the systems of discipline and incentivization and using the disciplinary system, we're probably failing, if I can make that general point, in managing what the problems are at localized levels. And of course, the broader policy issues and allocation of resources, Gideon has mentioned, and I think those are very important. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Brian, and you and your team. We are going to move on. We'll give you time to respond to some of the specific questions that were posed by members in their closing statements, and then any comments, because we are all on the same side trying to deal with a monster of a problem that we have in our facility.
Let me pick up on some of the issues that we can deal with. Some of them we may well want to put some hard facts on the table and follow them up in writing. I think in essence, we need to recognize that we are dealing with an evolving and changing process. And I think that in that sense, we need to ensure that we do not approach our gang management strategy as something that is cast in stone. You do this, and therefore you've solved the problem. We have approved as a working document for implementation, but also for further consultation, the gang management strategy. We will make that available to the portfolio committee with a view that it has to remain perpetually a living document. It's not a B order. You do this and you solve the problem. It has to remain a strategic document. It will have to be fed with trend analysis, an ongoing evaluation of the way in which our offenders, the nature of our offenders has changed. And I think that Mr. Mutsiki had indicated that. What it means also, though, for our security strategy within the department is that the management of security-related information becomes a critical part of being able to address this. And I think that the elements of the presentation that speak to our ESG capacity and restructuring security will add value in relation to that aspect. On the issue of the balance between the privacy of an inmate versus the privacy of somebody who's violating human rights within a prison facility, we would certainly request that the Portfolio Committee does engage with this issue in depth. We will make available to the committee the UN prescripts that deal with the issue of the balance between privacy, so that we're able to have an in-depth approach to it that can engage with the international instruments, because it's those international instruments that raise the issue of the violation or the invasion of individuals' private rights as opposed to the protection of the collective rights. And we would certainly appreciate the guidance of the South African Parliament in relation to that, the balance that we need to find in relation to that. But it is there's a body of international instruments that we would need to engage with. On the questions that were asked in terms of the vetting of personnel, if it's okay, can we provide that in writing? Because we would need to give you that breakdown. We had already explained in the previous engagement on the issue of rape within our facilities that in ensuring a good couple of years back that we ensured that our assault statistics included rape, that we landed up where the MIS now deals with it as an aggregate category, and we had already indicated that we will ensure that we can disaggregate it while at the same time ensuring that we're able to pull the collective information together. So that issue will be attended to. The issue of the use of the term sexual violence as opposed to rape is something that historically predates the Sexual Offences Act. Obviously, with the new definition of rape in terms of the Sexual Offences Act, we now will be using rape as an all-encompassing process. I think that's where that issue comes from. There was an issue raised around the causes of death unknown. I think part of what we need to recognize is that as we produce statistics, there are investigations or post-mortems or autopsies that have not necessarily reached the conclusion. Until it's reached that conclusion, a death may well land up being classified as a cause unknown. But I think that's part of the difficulty of ongoing information. There's no point at which there isn't a process in relation to those deaths. I think that the members of the Portfolio Committee have reflected very strongly that gangsterism is not something that is new, it's not something that is likely to go away, it is an international phenomenon. And that's part of why we've adopted the approach of having a gang management strategy, because it is an issue that one needs to manage. For me, what the Portfolio Committee should... And what we've had to acknowledge ourselves is that there are, in fact, elements of practice that have been developed in different centres at different times that have really been quite effective. Polesmore at one stage had a process of being able, as people are admitted, to disaggregate people who are known gang members and those who are not. Those processes are innovative, useful, and yes, again, it is... Can we do that in every single centre, given our levels of overcrowding and our architecture of the facility? It may not be possible in a particular centre to disaggregate the vulnerable groups and the hardened offenders in the way that one would want to do. But part of what the gang management strategy will do is to lift up those best practices. If I'm not mistaken, it was precisely in Barberton, although I may have the centre wrong, in which there was a period of very little gang violence, precisely because of the way in which that head of centre had interacted with those offenders to, in a sense, get an agreement if you're involved in gang activity, these are going to be the consequences. If you choose not to be, these are the ways in which we can actually organize the center. So, to a very large extent, we can have a gang management strategy, we can have the law, we can have all the policy and procedure in the world. To a very large extent, it depends on how our heads of center and our area commissioners manage those facilities that actually gets us to best practice. And I think that the direction that you've given us of ensuring that our managers spend more time in centers and on the ground is going to assist in making sure that the gang management strategy really does become a document that can assist us with the practice. We've noted the issues that are raised by the inspecting judge around the reporting responsibilities, and I will certainly go and look at what the situation is in relation to that and provide feedback on those issues. The issue of the discipline versus the incentivizing, I think, is part of what I've been trying to reflect in the use of that example, that there's a carrot and stick process. The issue of the single cell, it's a very interesting and it's a very complex issue. And as people are talking, I'm reflecting back on engagement with portfolio committees over the past year. Obviously, we have facilities that are designed with communal cells, and in that context, you have a constraint of having to locate people within them. The expenses of designing something with purely single cells versus communal cells, I don't know. I haven't done a detailed costing of it, but I would think that it would probably change the cost of that quite seriously. But we would certainly need to look at that. But there's the other element of life in a single cell through a 10-year or 20-year sentence and life in a communal cell. While from a security perspective, it's easier to assert security if you've got everybody in a single cell. The impact on a human being of being locked up in a single cell for extended periods of time over the length of a long sentence is disastrous. So somewhere there's a balance, and it obviously relates back to the issues of to what extent have we got inmates involved in productive activity and rehabilitation programs and sport. In the context in which we're still battling to try and do that, the issue of them spending time in a communal cell and having the benefits of human interaction becomes an important aspect. But then we need to have the mechanisms to be able to check on what is happening, and it goes back to the issue of using technology to be able to observe what is happening in those cells and in that sense to be able to provide supporters. So I think that in concluding, unless there are issues from the security team that they want to pick up on, we're dealing with a fundamentally complex issue. But fundamentally, the solutions to lie in ensuring that we've got the policy and procedure, we've got the strategies, but actually in the day-to-day management of those centres, and being able to ensure that we've got the checks and balances that I think Chairperson raised right at the beginning of this discussion. But let me perhaps just give Mr. Motseki a chance to wrap up.
Just two things. I think they all the issues have been covered. Just two things. One is that the presentation, so far as it relates to the gang management strategy, we're reflecting on the document. We're not reflecting on what we're doing or not what we're doing. I'm just taking to the point that Mr. Abrams was taking to. So indeed, we register all forms of violence with the police as a criminal offense. And so all the short-term issues relate to the current obligations we have, but they had to be in the document. And so they are reflected as such here. There is a strange thing about medical overdose. You give a person a tablet and put it on that, they're chewing, isn't it? They're chewing, and then you pick up your tablet, you put it in, get water, you drink. But it's under your tongue, and then you pack them up. After a while, you just drink all of them in one go. The law makes provision that an awaiting trial, as an example, can receive medication from, so they get checked, they receive them, they pack them up, overdose themselves. So it's some of those unfortunate things that you cannot direct. And sometimes these are people you least expect. You least expect that this person is about to commit suicide. You least expect, but this is a conscious effort of an individual who's not going to spend 15 years there. You're just not going to spend that 15 years. So there is a commitment to get the concoction of tablets. So there are all sorts of illness, headache, this, that, but we keep on collecting this tablet. So it's a very unfortunate thing, but it does happen. I mean, it's the same as a person ripping. I still cannot understand it. They keep on trying to explain it to me. But how does a person hang with a sheet against the window in a single cell? But it happens. I'm saying it's your body of your weight that will pull you down and break the neck. But these people committed to death as opposed to serving a sentence. They will do it. I still can't understand how it happens, but you find people in their single cells hanged, having died, and so on. So it's unfortunate, but it's a very difficult thing to process, and they do happen. The post-mortems will say that there is an over supply of a specific medication of one form or that. I'm sure even reports of the inspecting judge, when they do that investigation, they'll often find those sorts of reports, that there has been an excessive use of a specific medication which was the direct cause of death.
Thank you very much to all our participants. I thought it was a very useful exercise. I really did think it was a useful exercise, and that this is not, as in the past, a matter that will have been discussed, and by blind compliance we will then tick it off and say we've dealt with sexual violence as a committee. You can rest assured that this is the beginning of a dialogue that we all need to have and continue to have. So this committee will engage as many stakeholders and interested parties as possible. But ultimately, the talking will stop and the implementation will have to proceed. So thank you very much for that. And we're also inviting anybody else that was here that wants to join the dialogue. You're free to engage with the committee around gangsterism and so on. I think the message that we are sending to the department, or not sending to the department, but the message is to everybody here, that this committee is committed to and will always respect human rights, as the white paper and the constitution and everything else says. However, those human rights must also be a right that is earned by inmates. If this committee is going to respect his human rights or her human rights, he or she must respect the rights of those that they are abusing or are dehumanizing currently. I think that's the message that we are sending across. We are committed to rehabilitation of inmates, and that is why we will continue to talk about inmates spending more time in productive hours outside than being locked up, whether it is in the factories, whether it is, but this committee is going to move towards ensuring that inmate labor and self-sufficiency remains on the agenda. And we will make that noise whenever we meet the department and whenever we meet anybody that's related to it. We just do not believe 23 hours in the cell is conducive to rehabilitation, and today we re-emphasize that it is the breeding ground of violence of all sorts of nature and forms in the cell. So it reinforces our own argument that the correct thing to do is for them to be out there being productive. Which brings us to the last point to the department, that if that is the thinking of the of the committee, then there is an urgent need for us to revisit our shift system so that we don't have a situation where officials are put at risk because of the ratio between officials and inmates. Somebody correctly said that it's about the whole thing. We can't look at one in isolation of the other. So we will continue to knock on the doors of the department asking it to refine its subsystem. We will continue, Mamelo, to knock on the door of the ministry to say you need to shift your budget towards what would make this thing work as opposed to what we've had currently. We will continue to knock on the doors of those that are wiser than us in the private sector to engage with them on the debate around matters that are very serious for this committee. I think you've gathered from today's engagement that members of this committee are serious about changing the way things are done in the facilities for the better. So thank you very much to everybody. We meet the department on the 2nd. But just to remind the department that we'd expect a written report on the vetting. We'd expect a written report on the Mark Scott Crosley issue. And we would expect that when we arrive at Westville on Wednesday, that the RC gives us a briefing around the incident that is currently on the court papers that we were supposed to discuss. Those are the three immediate ones. Thank you very much to everybody. We have another session. Members need to stay behind. You can have a 2-minute body break for members, and then we'll do the last agenda item. But all members must stay behind. Thank you.
No,
sorry, the third session is a closed session. I think.